Ukvig first I haimi, ergove gerum studu, ok I halhars hanna brindu. Thrice var brindu, thrice var borna, opt os yaldan ton hon in lifer. Heidi hanna hetu, vars till hossa kom, volu velspa, vitti hon ganda, seth hon vars hon kuni, seth hon hugleken. I var honna angan ilrar bruthar. The war I remember, the first in the world, when the gods with spears had smitten Gulveig, and in the hall of Hur had burned her, 3 times did they burn her, and yet 3 times was she born again. Yet ever does she live. Hythe they named her, who sought their home, the wide-seeking witch, in magic wise. Minds she bewitched that were moved by her magic, to evil women a joy ever was she. Welcome to The Sacred Stew. I am your host, James, and this is my co-host, Anthony. And this week's episode, we are going to discuss Sather. We're going to discuss Loki and his influence. We're going to discuss a few aspects that hopefully will tie together. This is a free-flowing conversation between Anthony and myself. Before we jump into the conversation, the discussion, I just want to let you guys know that The Sacred Stew is on YouTube. It is also on Spotify, and you can find us in Telegram as well. So if you haven't followed or liked or shared our podcast yet, be sure to do so. This is the home of anything that has to do with Germanic theology, history, and the like. So with much ado, Anthony, it's been a couple weeks since we've been on. We had to take a week off there just to kind of do some personal life stuff that was going on in our lives. You have anything new to report? Up to my place a couple times in the last couple weeks, and yesterday we got together for your birthday, my birthday, and my son's birthday as well. That was a good time.
That was. You got me a really cool shirt. We shared some mead. We all roasted each other a little bit. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, you had definitely had the best roast for my son. You have that honed into the T.
Yeah, well, I love the kid, but he makes it so easy.
He's a good kid, man, and he's got a bright future ahead of him. I'm excited to watch him grow and develop over the years and have good folk around him like you and Noah and Kurt and the rest of the tribe.
Yeah, he's definitely going to be a good addition to counteract the overall degeneracy we're seeing these days.
So yesterday when you were here, we were just kind of having a light discussion about what we should talk about today. And you wanted to somehow, I guess, talk about the influence of Loki in this world, what that looks like, what that means. Does he even have influence? What does he have to do with anything happening today when the gods have essentially bound and tied him away? And I opened up this podcast reciting the Voluspa stanzas 21 and 22. And I think this sort of ties together with a broader conversation that I wanted to talk about Sather, magic, influence, how it works whenever you are giving offerings or calling upon or invoking certain gods. You want to kind of tell us your thoughts and how this conversation kind of evolved or spurned itself?
So the thought kind of came from a telegram chat that you and I are in, and somebody had brought up, could Baldur receive offerings because he is in Helheim, and could Loki receive offerings because he is bound? And the guy, it's one individual had said that no, they neither could receive offerings. And on Baldur's point, I was like, well, that doesn't make sense because we give offerings to our ancestors who are in Helheim and they receive it. And then the bit on Loki, that kind of spun into a whole conversation on there. And when I look around and, you know, granted, I live in the Portland, Oregon area. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But I've just heard people say, and you have this opinion, it's not the first time I've heard it, that because Loki is bound, he has no means of interactions and he cannot receive offerings. And on it, I have no proof to the contrary, other than there's nothing directly said that he can't. Yes, he is bound, but he still has his mind. And any beings of chaos, I do not feel, are necessarily bound to the gift exchange. They can tap it, but they are able to influence regardless. And I don't believe Loki would have the power of intervention necessarily due to the fact that he is bound. But I definitely believe he still has a level of influence. And for me, the difference being is that intervention is very active. And, you know, those moments where it's like, holy crap, somebody was just looking out, somebody just cut in on my behalf. To where influence is very passive, subtle. And I do not believe that any being that has people worshiping them could do that without at least having some level of influence. And you see a similar concept with, I forget if it's the Jews or the early Christians, but Azazel is a demon who is chained under the earth, but still has the power to influence. So I don't necessarily like tying different faiths together. But I think his bindings might limit him, but it doesn't completely cut him off, because he still has his mind. And if he has his mind can reach any realm and touch it.
Well, I opened this up, this episode, reciting those verses from Voluspa, because I really think that this gets to the heart of your question. We know from previous episodes that we've done, when we've examined who Loki is and his relationship and binding and stuff, his trial in the Lokasana, when the gods bind him until Ragnarok. In previous episodes, I've went into my theory about Loki actually being Lothar. And I think all of this ties together. And I think it ties together a lot with how people practice their day-to-day religion and how they understand our Germanic theology and how it works. So I guess the question is, you know, because when you ask somebody, you know, who is so-and-so, like, for example, who is Odin? And they will say, well, he is the god of knowledge. Whereas what we're not talking about, you know, classifying the gods and this archetypal sort of understanding of who they are, but more or less what their spirit or soul or their purpose is. So in the example of Odin, for example, we can say, well, he's not the god of knowledge. He's the god of knowledge seekers. And so when we relate this to Loki, I think we can take a very similar type of approach to it, where we can say, you know, Loki isn't the god of chaos, but Loki is a god for people that seek chaos. Does that make sense?
I would add not violent chaos or anarchy. I would like subterfuge. The people that want to be the cancer in the greater cell. Mm-hmm. Whether that's how they think of it or not, it's for the people that are not, for the outcasts, for the people that are not spiritually fit to contribute to society. And they can't destroy it through conquest. So, you know, subterfuge and poison to destroy, and the loners, the ones that are loners because they just refuse to fit in or can't. I don't know if that makes sense.
Right. No, I understand what you're saying in that regard. I guess I'm trying to go to kind of a deeper element to it, though, that there is a spirit or a soul that is more the force than the individual outlet. So we know, like, from those passages in Voluspa where it speaks about Gullveig Hæd being born three times, that she essentially was able, her soul survived, and Loki ate the heart each time. And what it's speaking about is that he's eating her essence. He is consuming it. He is becoming her. And that from this, they breed a lineage of mutts. They breed a lineage of people or folk or entities or beings that have this soul or purpose. And their whole point is to turn our folk away from our gods. Think of it as, you know, a magical war per se, because when we talk about magic, we're not talking about, for example, the ability to snap your fingers and make flame appear at your fingertips. You know, that's not what we're speaking about when we're speaking about magic. When we're speaking about magic, we're speaking about the ability and the power to influence the outcome of things. So that is what Gullveig Hæd represents, and what we're told from our ancestors in these poems is essentially those that are evil follow her way. And Loki, essentially, if my theory holds correct, where Lothar was originally Loki, we have, you know, this being that changed weird, that changed the course of fate by consuming her soul or essence, and essentially becoming traitorous or, you know, committing treachery against the Aesir and his own brothers. And this essence, he was able to essentially influence the outcome of fate and history, because you set in motion different things when you use words or you do actions that affect other people. These are sort of like magical spells that you're doing. Most people do it very unconsciously. They don't even think about their words. Words today do not have the same impact as, or words today are not understood to have the same meanings as they once did. People change our vocabulary, our definitions of words. There's words that didn't exist even 50 years ago. You go look in a dictionary from 50 years ago and try to look up the word transsexual, for example. that did not exist in dictionaries 50, 60 years ago. Trannies did not exist in the dictionary 50, 60 years ago. These are new words that we create today in our society. And this is just a really simple example of it, but it's an example of how people influence by the usage of their words, because now this is a common word today. It is a word that's being propagated in all sorts of media outlets. And I think of the way that Loki works in the spirit of Gullveig is in a very similar fashion. I don't know if any of that made sense, but that was my little just rant on it. What do you think?
I mean, that was a little deep, but what I got out of it was so I would use the term more spiritual warfare than magic, just because to me a spiritual war it incorporates the type of magic that you were talking about, but it's more than just our realm or just the realm of the gods, but the whole cosmos. It encompasses the whole cosmos. And it kind of touched on, you know, when I mentioned subterfuge, that in changing words and adding words, it can mutate or dilute the meaning of those words to the point where the things said do not have the power that they once did, or because we don't know what we're saying, the words that we speak have a different outcome than what we intended to.
Yes, exactly. And the reason why this is important to really kind of understand is when we get down to one of the things, words that has been changed over time, is the word Sather, or the practice of a form of magic that we only know of because of descriptions that were left in the poems and other writings that we find, where they don't actually they don't actually say Sather is this, this, and this, and this, and this, whereas they describe like the outcomes or use words like evil people follow this, or, you know, things like that. So I think when we talk about the changing of the words over time, Sather being a good example of it, in today's age, there's many people that believe that Sather is a legitimate magical practice that people should learn and practice. What's your idea of what Sather is, Anthony?
If I was going to give a modern correlation, it would be anything that today we would call black magic. Magic for bad, outcomes for others, personal gain. Yeah, that's the best way for me that I can describe Sather. Is it to anybody familiar with magical systems today, it's black magic, our equivalent of, I would go as far to say left-hand path, or as much as I hate using this example, satanic or Luciferian magic equivalent.
Well, there's a lot of people today that would argue that that is just the Christianized way of trying to put a bad image on what our folk magic was. You know, they'll say that, well, the Christians called all of our magic, you know, evil and black and dark and such. What's the reply to that?
That you look at the sources where Sath is specifically being mentioned, and it's always by an evil witch or an Urgi man, when magic was in our myths, when magic was used for good purposes or for to contribute or for divination or whatever, it wasn't called Scythe. Scythe was never brought into it. But I do believe that just as the Christians essentially invented the egregore of hell to be Loki's daughter, and therefore, you know, you don't want to go to Helheim because it's a bad place, it would have been very easy at the time for the new Christian converts to just say all magic is Scythe, because your general, your run-of-the-mill, they're going to know what Scythe is, and if they're converting or thinking of converting, and you just blankly call all magic black magic and evil, that's going to stick, especially when that side wins in history.
A lot of people think that Scythe was like the an energy magic that people would practice. And I want to talk a little bit about what it actually is and what it describes, or what is being described when it's spoken about. So Scythe, when we use this term, essentially we are using a term that means the manipulation of one's mind. So to essentially get somebody or something to do something that is outside the course of their fate. One example, and we brought this up in season one when we were talking about Freyr and his marriage to Gerd. So people are aware, Gerd's mother is Gullveig Hyde. Ingrabolda is Gullveig, and what had happened is Gullveig had essentially cast a love spell upon Freyr, so much to the extent that he was growing sick in his love for Gerd. And so what we see here is that there was some type of spell that caused Freyr to fall in love with Gerd. And she, to him, was the most beautiful being, and he was strongly attracted to her, even though that wasn't his fate, even though the other gods and goddesses of the Aesir did not want this marriage to happen. And we see through this that the course of fate changed, because part of the gifts that were given to Gerd was Freyr's sword, the one that is then later used against the gods at Ragnarok. So when we're talking about Scythe, what we're really talking about, it's not the manipulation of energies. It's not a shamanistic practice. Although many many people today do think Scythe was a shamanistic practice, that's not actually what Scythe is. It is the use of any magical system to manipulate other people's minds to get them to do things outside of their fate. So in the modern era, when we look at this, we can look at things like the television or the radio, as music is a really good example as well, where you have these messages that are given to people in a way that subconsciously absorbs into their mind. This, you know, we get back to this vertical transmission of information versus the horizontal transmission, where people are told to, you know, certain things that may be wrong, incorrect, may encourage people to do things that are just morally wrong. For example, most modern music today glorifies sex and drugs and all these materialistic things. And this is a magic that's being worked. These are powerful, powerful magical spells that are being sent out among the people. And it's important that people understand and recognize this to be able to break these spells that hold us and hold our minds captive, dumb us down, as they say.
You say that, and I think back to the rap of the early 90s that was all about gangbanging and F the police and, you know, shooting this and selling drugs. And, you know, then we've got so many people locked up, you know, and, you know, then coming in, you know, late early 2000 to the 2010s, 20 teens, the music changed to, I got to get high to deal with life. I'm suicidal. Don't care about anything or anyone. And then we've got a generation of selfish people that can't refuse to see that they're a greater whole. People that were on the outskirts of society for a reason are welcomed into the greater whole, and everything starts to degenerate.
Well, it's really unfortunate that people often don't even realize that, you know, that they're entranced in this modern culture, that this is actually a perversion of their minds that's happening. And this is one of the things that we have to try to fight back against by educating our folk and our children and our families, educating our communities about. Now, let's get back to Loki here for a bit, because I did want to tie all of this together. Now, you had mentioned that you think that Loki still gets benefit from offerings that are made to him. And theologically, you know, we know, well, I guess we can say cosmologically, that these offerings, you know, certainly are an energy exchange that happens. But I don't think with the binding of Loki in the greatest recesses of Niflhel, where he's bound at until Ragnarok, that he can actually benefit from this. We have an example, Saxo, that wrote about it, and they travel on some ships and travel to the place, Niflhel is what's being described, in search to give an offering to Loki. And then misfortune ends up becoming of everyone that went on that journey. They all eventually died, and I think that's the only real example in our histories and lores that we have of somebody that was seeking to worship Loki, even though that's debated exactly what they were doing. But people, at least people that are educated a little bit about the history and the mythology of it, they use this example as an example of people worshiping Loki. But they don't finish the story off where misfortune ends up coming of everyone that did that. And that was King Worm, the story that Saxwell had written about King Worm. And he wanted to go see if the tales of Gunmund the Giant and his treasures were true. So they ended up losing almost all of their men, just on the journey there, and those that did survive afterwards were cursed.
I haven't heard that one, but I can see how half educated people would use that as a reason to worship him. But I mean, personally, I would go as far to say these people are so broken that they wouldn't care about the consequences.
As the story goes, King Gorm prays to Utgard Loki, and according to the story, that his prayer was answered. Then at the end of a prolonged life, King Gorm was convinced by some men that souls were immortal, and as a result, contemplated where he would go when he died. when he was in this state of mind, enemies of Thorkell convinced the king that the powers of heaven insisted that Loki, Utgard Loki, the bound demon that he had previously prayed to, must be appeased, and that Thorkell was just the man for the job. So Gorm's praying to Loki was driven by his extreme need and fear for his life, and he had to atone for doing so or risk not going to heaven, right? So Saxo goes on to explain that others laid information against him as guilty of treachery and an enemy of the king's life. Thorkell, seeing himself doomed to extreme peril, demanded that his accusers should share his journey. They then had aspersed an innocent man that they saw the peril they had designed against the life of another, and reconciled upon themselves and tried to take back their plan. So he forced them to sail under the command of Thorkell, and essentially, if they didn't, he accused them of cowardice. And these men saw that they essentially had no choice but to make this journey, and they couldn't possibly avoid peril. So they covered their ship with hides, and they filled it with a lot of food. So they expected this journey to take a very long time, and they sailed away. And essentially, they sailed so far that they came to a land that had no sun, and it didn't have any stars, and it was void of all daylight, according to Saxo. And eventually, after sailing for a long time, they see this strange-looking sky. And they didn't have any more food. They were tired and exhausted. There was no way for them to actually boil any of the meat. The meat ends up rotting. And they ended up eating the raw hides that they had put around the boat because they were so hungry, right? Most of them that ate that got very sick were very ill. So this is the strongest piece of evidence that any person that wants to try to justify the worship of Loki can use in that. It's the only reference to it. So, essentially, according to Saxo, if this is Utgard Loki, we know from the story that this being is chained up in a place of punishment, just as Snorri and the Eddic poems describe the bounding of the gods of Loki. And the question comes, you know, who would worship a bound enemy of the gods destined to lead the inhabitants of Niflhel to battle with the gods in certain death? In my mind, only a deranged person would knowingly stand against the gods and our folk to openly confess that fate. And so that king knew that he was destined for a treacherous journey after his death. He knew that. He knew he was cursed for doing that. And secondly, everyone that went on that journey essentially became sick, ill, and dead. That was the end result.
I forget who told me this story. Forget where I heard it. But I was talking to somebody, and or maybe I was listening to somebody, and they were talking about how they used to let Lokians into their circle. And he said that two things really stuck out to him when that happened. First, that the Loki worshipers, he definitely saw that they got good from it. However, when he was toasted at Bloats or in Sumble, those that didn't had some really bad luck and some really messed up stuff happen within a short period of time after that. So when I hear that and I see the correlation today, when you already know you're burnt, some people just try to make the best of it, or no, that not make the best of it. in their own twisted way, they try to turn it into a positive.
Yeah.
And that is where I see the draw to him is you have people with a spiritual deficit or people that have given up on the things that makes the greater whole and themselves better in order to have pleasure and the material things. And you just get to a point where you're damned, and so you're going to go out like a rock star. Damn the consequences.
Well, I think that, you know, as far as Loki's influence itself, I think it's definitely passive. And that's what the binding represents. Of the gods of Loki, even sewing his lips shut, tearing his guts out. So I don't think that he can actively, influence things in the sense of he's not out there creating new things, but he's already created his children. And we are essentially reverberations of the past. Ideas, you know, mostly aren't new today. They've been around for a long time. And these ideas that exist, because it exists, it is a power source, if that makes sense. It is something that is real. And it does influence passively, but it's really those who fall under that influence that are the real workers and benefactors of, you know, that validation of that god. There's a reason why I believe that Lothar was Loki, and I believe Loki was a name that was used as essentially a banned term, you know, that they banned the usage of his true name to hide him from history, to hide him in what he's done as much as they could. And by speaking to these things, we empower that mythology of it, if you will, that mythological history of it. So those that choose openly, knowingly, with knowledge, choose to actually openly worship Loki and give blessings to him, they're making a conscious choice of being a person of chaos. And this is where we get back to, you know, the gods or the archetypes aren't the real thing. It's not the god of this, but it is the god of people that, you know, are in pursuit of a certain end goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
And I don't really think it's Loki's influence so much as Gullveig hides, you know, because we can't forget that there is a transformation when he eats her heart. He's consuming her essence or her soul. And it is that influence that causes this change in him, where he begins doing things that change the course of fate for the gods, the universe as a whole, and our own folk today. And this change happens at such a point that the gods themselves end up sending Heimdall here to give us knowledge of what our fate is and how we protect it and what we are supposed to do in our lives in building towards the future.
We've touched on the Rig Skula directly once and periodically. So for those unfamiliar, go back to past episodes.
Well, and this gets at the heart of another debate, and I don't know how much we want to jump into this rabbit hole, but the question of like a revealed religion versus a natural religion, if you will, where a lot of people point towards, like, they'll use the example of that when somebody receives a message and they pass that message on to people, that that's considered like a revealed faith or a revealed knowledge. They use Abrahamic faith as such, Muhammad being a prophet that received revelations from an angel, quote unquote, that this is a religion or a way of life that's revealed to them. Many people would say that our faith is not a revealed faith, that it's a natural faith of living in tune with nature's law. And I don't disagree with that statement, but at the same time, I do believe that parts of our faith are revealed because we have stories of the Valkyries, the gods, such coming here and giving information to us, to our ancestors, and to us even to this day.
So I think there's a subtle thing, because I can't really say my thought without repeating what you just said, but our whole religion isn't based off a revelation. There's revelation aspects, but it's not, we didn't get our faith from one man going into the woods or going into a cave and allegedly seeing some vision or getting shown some tablets or this, that, and the other thing. It was predominantly compounded on from every generation from the beginning, and snippets of intervention happened along the way. It didn't make the religion, but it got it back on course. It got the spiritual foundations of our folk back on course.
Well, because there was a spiritual war that was happening. Just as we know about the coming of Heimdall, it also speaks in our lore about how Gulveig went home to home. So as Heimdall is spreading knowledge and spreading the divine seed within our folk, we have Gulveig doing the same thing as it's described in our lore. Now, does that mean that that being itself is the literal one that's going into these homes, into these villages, and teaching these things? No. But it's her magic that is doing that. It's her swaying of the mind, polluting the mind in a way that, that people turn away from their gods, and that people are not in their natural state with their gods. So for today's day and age, when we have all of these misunderstandings over definitions of words, and people being essentially lost and not just essentially not having the knowledge of the history of it, they grasp onto little things, like they may get one book and they base their whole practice off this book. Or you have various people that try to, like the Wiccans, for example, where that was an attempt to try to reconstruct the old pagan faith of Europe, although a very bad attempt at it, and a lot of syncretism involved in it. But even, you know, people just grab onto these things and not knowing, you know, what these things are made of and why these things are being done, they want to be able to do the snap of the finger and have fire shooting from their fingertips or something. But the true magic is in your influence, your words and your actions that you do that influence everything around you. Are you influencing for the good, or are you influencing for the bad? Are you influencing for our folk, or are you influencing for folk outside of our circles? That's what I believe we are talking about when we're talking about Sather, that it's the influencing of the mind. Because historically, we know that there was only a handful of different types of magic from the sources that we have that are attested and verified that our folk practice. And Sather is not one of them. We have essentially the Hamr, the changing of forms. We have the spa, the prophecy. And then we also have a galdr, which is a singing or chanting magic. And that the Galdr is the magic that Odin and the gods gave to us. That is the form of magic that we're to practice. A lot of people will point at how Odin practiced Sather, that he learned it, that Freya taught. They believe it, that Freya taught it to all of the Aesir. But what had actually happened is Gullveig Hyde, going by the name of Orboda, becomes a handmaiden of Freya, and Gullveig perverts Freya's mind and teaches her this magic. And when she does so, Freya shows the other gods what she has learned. And Odin ends up seeing, and we've been through this in an episode in season one, but just to recap it, Odin sees the harmful uses of what Sather is and how it's causing people to do things that aren't in their natural state. And he ends up banning the practice of Sather. So this is something that Odin himself has told us not to practice. And in the Voluspa, it tells us, you know, only the evil person or the wicked person follows this path. What Sather is the manipulation of the mind that takes people out of their natural state or being and causes influences in things that change the natural course of fate. This all ties into weird and how it works and how it's woven together by the Norns and the fight between the gods over the mead, the sacred mead, and the control of destiny and fate. So Sather itself is not ever described as, you know, a certain type of traditional practice in the sense of do this, and this. And then you are practicing Sather, but rather it's mentioned as a reference that people that do certain types of acts are practicing Sather. Later on, during the Christian conversion period, what ends up happening is they equate all of the traditional folk magic as black magic. And this is how the term Sather became popularized for all forms of folkish magic, because the Christians essentially had defined it as such. As far as Loki's influence, I think that we should really call it Gullveig's influence. I think that that spirit certainly lives on. I certainly think that they can be empowered in different ways. But with the sole existing example that we have from our lore, those that actually do try to worship Loki, their ends come of misfortune.
I agree that people do it to their detriment. But I would honestly think that the people that are doing that, what we would call their detriment to them is their benefit. Like, I mean, whether it's Loki and Gullveig or just Gullveig or something, another angle that we're not seeing, I just thought it was important to acknowledge something was there and give a perspective a little bit more in depth than, oh, Loki and Gullveig are bad and they're evil. Like, and because we've talked about or made mention of, you know, the degeneracy and stuff, and with our episode on the history of the Christian conversion, I thought it would make sense to touch on the spiritual roots of the problems that we're seeing today. Because I do think you know, whether Loki himself is actually influencing anything. We're still feeling the consequences of his actions. Gullveig is definitely here. With this going on YouTube and Spotify, I want to try to be careful of calling certain things out. But when you understand the aspects of those two and you look at the big cultural movements going on today, you can very clearly see that influence.
I mean, there is certainly a influence that happens, but we know this from Voluspa, where it's talking about, you know, brothers will slay brothers and sisters and brothers will conjugate, you know, have children together, and essentially blood will fill the streets. I certainly think that we see that today. I see signs that, I don't know if we're in the age of the wolf per se, exactly as people call it, but certainly nearing it. Our society today is under a heavy influence of some power or entity that has a universalist or global approach to it. And we have a real need to awaken our folk to what's going on, and to call them back to the sacred path that we follow. I mean, I don't know what much more to say on it in regards to that, because I think we've covered a lot about Loki and Gullveig in previous episodes. But I certainly think that all of the manipulation that we see gets back to the root. If you want to give it more than just, you know, Gullveig and Loki bad, don't do this, don't do that. What we're talking about is treachery, the changing of fate, where we have different tribes that are competing to control the fate of the universe per se, our lives. We are not, you know, anything on a level where we ourselves in this world can change the ultimate course of where the universe goes, but we can certainly change the path of those around us, starting with our own selves, and we can certainly have an influence in that. I don't know. You tell me. You drive the car, Anthony. You have a certain thought on what you want to discuss, so.
I honestly feel like we covered most of it. Like I said, I didn't want to give either of them a full episode. I kind of just wanted to just touch on it. And I didn't want this to be a definitive thing for anybody. This was just really one that I wanted to kind of put out there and get people thinking and looking at things, and I just felt like the subject had to be broached once, and I've pretty much put my thoughts out there, my perspectives, and, you know, I hope people found some value in it. Where I see Loki's biggest influence is the blurring of the gender lines in society today, with Loki being a full shapeshifter going back and forth. When we see, how do I word this? When we see so many of our folk blatantly saying that they don't care about their people, they attack their own people. You know, oh, we're horrible, we're this, we're that, or identifying with another folk And then with anger with Golvay, I would even go as far to say we see her influence in the modern feminist movement, where it's go get a career, don't worry about a family, you don't need a man, you know, and these women get to be 40, 50, 60 years old, no children, and they're miserable. And between the between both of those, it has destroyed our families. And destroying the family is the biggest hit our folk has taken in a long time.
Yeah, definitely. Very good points there on the modern influence of Loki and Golvay. We remember, I don't know if people remember, but in season one, in our episode about the soul, one of the things that I had talked about is how Golvay corrupted one of the souls, because she used to be a handmaiden of Freya and was involved in the process of delivering a soul or a being to the children. And we see it in the lore when it talks about poisonous fruit that fell from the tree, that she is injecting this poison into the souls and corrupting the souls before the child is even born. And this gets into why it's really important in the modern age for our birthing rites and rituals that we do, the name calling, or the name fastening, as it's actually called. We have a child being hopefully born today in our tribe. We all did offering to Frigga and Freyr regarding that. But I think that some of it is just innate within people when they're born. And I don't know, we talk about NPCs. Balian was talking about, he actually met a real life NPC the other night. And I think this is what we see, where there's soulless people in the sense of their souls come from a different source. And in the lore, when it's talking about, you know, these poisonous fruits that fall from the tree, that it is something where there's something that's already been corrupted outside of that. And when you talk about poisonous fruits or apples, there's the old saying that one bad apple spoils the bunch. So I think in our own traditional folklore, not necessarily like the mythic lore, but the folklore, we see time after time where there's some allegories to like an apple. We can talk about like Sleeping Beauty, for example, where she eats the poisonous fruit and it causes her to sleep. These are things that were really inladen within us. And I think this has to do with us having to protect our knowledge and our traditions and having a very strong circle about us in today's day and age, because that influence is so strong that you just let one bad person into your group and it can cause misfortune to everyone in that circle. That's a practical application for today that people can use in understanding the allegory of the importance of keeping your circle very sacred and holy, and being wise in who you let come into that circle with you. I still feel like we need to do an episode getting more into the specific magics, because just so our listeners may know, this conversation today is just kind of, it was from yesterday's conversation that we're having, and we had threw out some ideas. I sort of wanted to talk about Sather specifically in different forms of magic, and also with the coming of the winter feasts and rituals, that it'd be important to do an episode on that as well. And hopefully maybe next week we'll actually do that episode, because we are at that time of the year where we are doing these rituals to Freyr and the Alfar and the Disir. And then, of course, we still have to do part two of the Christian conversion of our folk, which will be really interesting. I've already been thinking along the lines on what to really touch. And then when we do that part two, we will be touching on the actual modus operandi, the MO that was used to absorb our belief systems into translating into Christian adherence, which will be an exciting topic to get into. Anthony, today, you know, I know that you felt it was important to kind of follow up about this topic because of that conversation that we had in that other chat. I don't know if we answered the questions about how great Loki's influence is, or how much power he actually has directly himself. And I don't know if we can ever answer that question. But I do think that we see an influence in today's society that is very Lokian. And I think that that influence dates back from the beginnings of times. And I think that in order for us to move forward today, we have to recognize what is going on around us and stick strong to our families and building sound, morally conscious children that can move forward in the next age and carry this tradition on and have more children and make our folks stronger. Do you have any parting thoughts?
No, like I said, I don't know if we answered the question, but I think we gave some pretty good depth to the question. I don't know if the question is ours to answer, but I would also agree that we need to build a defense against all this stuff. And the first thing to do, or the first way to do that, is you got to know what it is and call it what it is. We can't have a nameless, shapeless something that we're trying to guard against and teach our children against. So that was kind of that's why I thought it was important to talk about in the depth that we did, is I feel like even though we didn't answer the question, we at least named the problem and gave some specific things about why it is a problem.
Right. Well, in we can look at like the tradition of the bear. We know that the bear was very sacred to our folk. And the true name of the bear is not actually a word that's spoken. The word bear means the brown one. And that was said because there was a name taboo on the true name of the bear, because it was felt that if you said those names, that you call upon that spirit or that soul, and that it would come. And so I think that's true for most anything where there was a taboo on, like, the name. And if my theory holds true and accurate, with Lothar becoming Loki, I think that we see something as well where that even people that are calling Loki by the name of Loki, it's not truly calling upon his spirit or soul or his being per se. So with that, I don't have much else to say. I want to thank everybody for listening, and make sure that you tune in next week. We're going to go over the winter bloats and rituals and how that works. It'll be a very exciting episode to delve into. Anthony, you want to sign us off?
This has been the Sacred Stew. I am Anthony. My co-host is James. Y'all have a good night.